Good afternoon and welcome. Just great. Is everybody having a busy full day? I'm so glad that you found your way here. We are happy to have you at this workshop, which is number 420. I'm telling you that because we are videotaping this workshop, so we hope that when you love it and are so impressed with our wonderful panelists, that you will share this widely with other folks who are interested in learning more about stewardship in our congregations. We, as many of you know, have put together a little stewardship track, Wisdom and Generosity. We started yesterday. How many of you were here yesterday? Wonderful to have you back. We weren't sure how it would work to put these four together, but we're really glad that some of you are taking them as a whole because we really thought of them that way. Yesterday we had a wonderful introduction from the Reverend Lisa Greenwood with the Texas Methodist Foundation, and then we had a flash workshop about some of the best ideas out there in fundraising and shared some creative ideas. Today we're getting down to business, talking first about annual giving campaigns, and later on, our next workshop is about creative fundraising, Faithify, capital campaigns, that kind of thing. So glad you're here. I want to start us off with a reading, and then I will introduce our guests, our panelists. This is from a colleague of great esteem, A. Powell Davies, many years the minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C., Why I Come to Church. Let me tell you why I come to church. I come to church and would, whether I was a preacher or not, because I fall below my own standards and need to be constantly brought back to them. I am afraid of becoming selfish and indulgent. And my church of the free spirit, brings me back to what I want to be. I could easily despair. Doubt and dismay could overwhelm me. My church renews my courage and hope. It is not enough that I should think about the world and its problems at the level of a newspaper report or a magazine discussion. It could too soon become too low a level. I must have my conscience sharpened until it goads me to the most thorough and responsible thinking of which I am capable. I must feel again the love I owe to others. I must not only hear about it, I must feel it. In church, I do. I am brought toward my best, in every way brought toward my best. Thank you again for being here. We come together because we believe that bringing our best will make a difference in the world. And this is true in so many ways, not the least of which in how we use our resources to realize our mission together. So as we were planning these workshops, we knew that the one thing we really wanted to do was get the folks who are out there doing this work really well. So I am so proud to introduce you to our panel. Three of our Unitarian Universalist ministers who are doing wonderful work in the field, Tricia Hart, Marlon Lavenhar, and Peter Friedrichs, and all three of them will say a little bit about themselves, and they each have a little piece of the puzzle to offer. Then after they've shared for just a few minutes, they're going to talk together in response to each other, and then we're going to open it up for your questions. Thank you all for being here. Help me welcome these folks.
Good afternoon. It feels like tomorrow, I guess. It's a little late in the day in GA. It's great to have you all here today. I'm Reverend Peter Friedrichs. I just finished my 10th year as the pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Delaware County in Media, Pennsylvania. Media is a suburb of Philadelphia. We are a congregation that over the past 10 years has varied in membership between around 250 members and then starting to flirt with 300 and pulling back, but just kind of in that 250, 275 member range. And before I begin my part of the presentation, which is really to give you, whoops, let's see, well, there's some introductions, I guess, is to talk to you about an experience that we've had. I want to just say that this is our congregation's experience. I'm not here to say this is any kind of magic solution. I'm not here to say that this is something that you can just plug and play with your own congregations. All I'm trying to do is relate to you where we were and where we are now, and to tell you what that process has been like. So as I say, our congregation it has about 270 members at this point, and we, like I think a lot of our congregations, have struggled for years and years with a relatively flat result from our fund drive. We call it a fund drive, our annual fund drive. And I'll show you just over the past 7 or 8 years or so, you'll see that there, the trend here on the left shows our pledges in the top line and percentage pledges paid. And although you see it has trended up, it's gone up and down within a relatively narrow range. And that our average and median pledge, our average pledge stands at a little bit more than $1,800, and our median pledge, more significantly, has been flat or declining over time. So we were in a situation where our experience year to year was we were constantly struggling to generate the kind of funding that we wanted to generate to support our mission. And so a couple of examples of that, we had in several past years, we had to go back to the congregation a second time and ask for additional funds to meet our planned budget. And in some cases, we frame that as, can you make an additional one-time gift so that it doesn't get added to your pledge that we're going to ask you to add on to next year? And 1 year we had to furlough one of our staff members for a month, our director of religious education, for a month because we didn't have the funding to support that position in a full-time way. Has anybody here experienced anything like that before?
Yeah.
A few of us, right. I think it's a fairly common situation. And although we were seeing some growth in membership, as you see, our median pledge was either staying flat or declining. And so that median pledge we saw as a very important metric as to where we were with our generosity. And one thing I'll just say parenthetically is that if you're not keeping track of this kind of data, start doing it, because it is tremendously useful so that you can see where the trends are and you can analyze them and then consider what you might want to do about them.
Is so it per member or per family?
This is per pledge unit. So it would be either individuals or families, depending on how you count your pledge units. And I will also say that a median pledge of $1,000 or $1,200 is certainly very healthy, but the trend was what was concerning to us. So our board instructed our executive team to try something new, figure something out, do something bold to see if we could kind of shake things up a little bit. And so the executive team started to think about where we were and how we could break out of the pattern. And the first thing we thought about was the fact that when we ask someone to give a percentage increase over their prior year's pledge, if you roll that back to their original pledge, it starts with a fairly arbitrary number. So when you say, can you give 3% more this year than you did last year, or 7%, or whatever your number is, they're ultimately going back to wherever they started. And when you're new to the church, that number, you really don't know, and it's not representative. So we wanted to break out of that pattern of just asking for an increase over the prior year. We also had a very strong belief that if we set the bar high, that people would meet or exceed it. And we had seen this most particularly in our congregational culture with a new membership process. We had instituted a new membership process some 7 or 8 years ago that requires 4 one-hour sessions, we call it UU 101, before you're allowed to become a member of the church. And people are willing to do that. And so we made the expectation clear, we set the bar, and people were prepared to meet it. So we thought we could do that with our fundraising as well. Then being clear on what we're trying to accomplish and what our ask is. I know I don't want to be disparaging towards the UUA, but the UUA's targets on giving have complicated formulas, and you make adjustments for medical expenses or college education you're paying, that kind of thing. It gets very confusing, and so we wanted to try to find a way to just make the ask very clear and very simple. And then the last assumption was, whatever we get, it'll be better than what we've been getting. And so as a result of all of this thinking, we came up with a program that we called Five to Thrive. And Five to Thrive has as its primary focus an ask that all of our members contribute 5% of their annual gross income to the church. We acknowledge that you're not going to be there necessarily this year, but we want you to work towards it over, and we targeted a 3-year span of time. From wherever you are, get to 5%. And we thought 5% is going to be, we didn't know how much that would raise because we don't know what people in the congregation make. But rather than the toothing that a lot of Unitarian Universalist congregations have, instead of tithing, they tooth, right? That if we could get them to 5%, you haven't heard that before? Yeah, we don't tithe, we tooth. If we could get them to 5%, we would have more money than we knew what to do with. So that was our assumption. We didn't know how much we would get, but it would be more. And so we were clear in the ask, and then we were very clear in why we wanted to try to get a lot more out of our members. We talked about how about our mission. We had a fledgling, some might call it anemic, share the plate program, where we shared the plate for one half of our plate collection one Sunday a month. What we said as a goal, we want to be able to give away 100% of our plate every Sunday. That was the goal that we put out when we introduced Five to Thrive. We talked about fully funding our staffing so that we didn't have to keep struggling to pay our staff and be a fair compensation congregation. And we talked about being more effective in our outreach with our partners in the community. And so we launched this program year before last, and the results were, I think, fairly remarkable. We saw a 22% increase in total pledges last year over what was pledged the previous year, with a 20% increase in median pledging and a 14% increase in the average pledge. So we were very excited about those results. Now, it didn't get us all the way to where we wanted to go for this year. So, for example, we wanted to share 100% of the plate, 100% of the Sundays. We ended up being able to share the plate twice a month. We were thrilled with that. And by December, we had already shared more with our local community partners than we'd shared all of the previous year. And so that was a huge accomplishment for us. We also were able to fund, in this case, an interim DRE position that was full-time with a credentialed interim DRE. And we were very excited to be able to attract a high-quality interim DRE because of our funding. And I didn't check my clock.
4 minutes.
4 minutes. Okay, great. So that's been the result of this particular program in our congregation. You'll see on the pledges and paid for this year, there's a big divergence, and that's because we didn't have all the figures. That was for the pledges collected. We actually have been able to collect 94% of the pledges that were made for last year in the first year of Five to Thrive. So we're pretty pleased about that, and that's about what we budget as a 94% collection rate. Now, I want to be completely honest with you and transparent here because I think that's important. This year we decided to continue with the Five to Thrive approach. And this year we actually saw a pullback on the pledging. But it has not been that significant, and there were a couple reasons for it. So we had about an 8% decrease this year in overall pledges from last year's number. There's been a slight reduction in the average pledge, but the median pledge is held steady. And for us, again, looking at the median pledge, that's a very important metric. This result, the decline, is largely attributable to the fact that we had our second biggest giver in the congregation moved away, and we lost one of our members who really stretched last year and was extremely generous, felt they just couldn't continue to support us at that same level. If those two pledges had remained static, we would have had a slight increase in our pledges over last year. So we don't know what the future holds, but what we found, again, that when we were clear with people both as to what we were asking them to do and where their funding was going to go, and we set that bar high, people responded. So we were very pleased with that outcome.
Thank you. Hello. I'm Tricia Hart, the Reverend Tricia Hart, and I am currently serving the slightly waterlogged congregation in Charleston, West Virginia. I'm an interim minister. Extremely proud of the congregation who have been stepping up and finding ways to be helpful in the way that they do, even this week again. I've been a Unitarian Universalist for just about exactly 30 years, which means that for about 28 of those years, since I moved into lay leadership pretty quickly, I've been worried about money. I have been serving congregations as a minister for about 19 years, and for 15 of those years, I have worked also sometimes as a stewardship consultant, which means that I have worked with congregations most of the time because they want to do a capital campaign and they need help with that. Sometimes also if they have some strategic planning or work that they want done on annual stewardship. So I have been, shall we say, steeped in this for a very long time. And I have seen some trends which have led me, I'm sure you'll be shocked, to be a bit of a heretic about the ways that we raise money. That was supposed to be a laugh line. What I've seen is that expenses in our congregations for all kinds of very legitimate reasons have gone up pretty consistently over those 30 years. And I've watched as our revenue models have not changed very much. And the revenue is falling short of what we need in order to run the kinds of congregations that we know we want and that we know we want to be effective. The models that we have for raising money have been almost exclusively based on pledging and pledging members. I want to notice both of those things. Pledging as a model of giving, which is people make a commitment to give a certain amount in a certain amount of time, and members in particular, we allow other people to make pledges, but we expect pledges from our members. Those models have served us well. They served us very well for many of the decades in the 20th century. I believe that they are no longer adequate, and that not quite adequateness to the actual cost of our congregations has created tension among our congregations, especially those who serve in leadership, either professional or volunteer. Would you agree with me on that? Okay. All right. I mean, it could be that that's only been my experience. But I believe that not only is that the situation that we're in now, I believe that this is going to get harder. This will become more and more challenging. So what I'm interested in is, first of all, paying a bit more attention and a different kind of attention to what we already know about what makes people want to give, and then to also pay attention to what we need to know, what we need to learn. And what I'm referring to is that the edges of our congregations have begun to blur. Have you noticed this? We don't know as clearly who our membership is. The congregation in Charleston has 120 official members. There are 673 people who have liked that congregation's Facebook page. And that's without any promotion. Are those people in our congregation? Are the people who come to the congregational programs part of the congregation? We get confused about this, and our congregations are more and more available to people who may never set foot in the door because they are watching online services or they're connecting via social media or other programs that we do. So what I'm interested in is figuring out, as the edges of our congregations blur, how does that change or how might it change the way we ask for money, the way our revenue sources change. So this phrase, how we ask makes a difference, is pretty much the gospel of, has been, of the stewardship consulting program, and it's absolutely true. How you ask, Peter just talked about a whole program
which is being very intentional and careful about how people are asked to give. What I want to add to that is what we ask for makes, I believe, an even bigger difference. And let me be specific about that in a couple of ways. Not every contributor or potential contributor to our congregations pledges, and not every contributor will ever pledge. That's my conviction, and I've seen it be true. And I wanted to attribute this bit of wisdom to a very wise man named Kenan Callahan, who wrote a book 24 years ago about this, among other things, making the point that people give in different ways for different reasons, and so congregations need to provide different ways to give. I would argue that one of the most familiar different ways we have is the Share the Plate programs that we have. There are some people that give very generously in a Share the Plate program that might never pledge. If we didn't provide that Share the Plate opportunity, they might not be giving. That's a whole workshop in and of itself, so I won't stick with that. I will move on to a couple of the realities that we are living with and that are very challenging indeed. One is people do not attend regularly in most of our congregations. They used to. There are a variety of ways through social media or live streaming that they have access to the congregation. There is a growing competition for what are known as charity dollars, and that's not my data. That's many studies have indicated this, and a general trend toward giving for a purpose rather than to an institution. This is showing up in a variety of ways. And then there are extraordinary differences between generations in terms of how they give and why they give. If we use the names that we're kind of used to, the World War II generation and the baby boomers and Gen X and Gen Y and millennials, all of them are motivated differently to give. And I wanted to share with you one bit of wisdom that that Peter and Marlon and I heard part of our ministry days. I don't remember what session it was, that somebody pointed out that a millennial active devoted member of his or her congregation said that the only reason that that person ever gets cash is to put it in the plate. That is literally the only part of that person's life which requires cash money. We need to think about that. Couple more things. This is from, I put the title of the article, I made sure that it's still up, it's a few years old, and it's a very mind-blowing and useful resource. It's called Churches Need a New Giving Model by a man named Stephen Dilla. He boldly says that nearly 85% of every dollar given in the United States has the potential to go to churches, we just have to learn to ask for it, and he makes a couple of big points. He says that we can no longer assume that people assume that the leadership, professional and lay, in congregations is making effective choices about money. And that if we don't have and provide data on the effects of how people are giving, then the assumption is that either we don't care or we have something to hide. Those are bold and scary words, but they rang true to me. There are studies that indicate that, in this case, over half of those born after 1979, so all of my children, agree that the ability to see the impact of their donation has a significant bearing on their decision to give. If they can know where the money is going and what difference it's making, they will give. If they cannot see that or have it reported in some way, they may choose not to give at all. And then Mr. Dilla goes on to make a really bold assertion. He says that the very ways in which we manage our church budgets has to change. And I've shown this slide and mentioned this to groups of ministers, and they all the color drains out of their faces when they hear this. I'm sure church treasurers would as well. What he calls the old model is a single operating budget. We've been working very hard for decades to get everything into a single operating budget. And occasionally there will be dedicated funds that is limited to something special. He says, and I think it's worth thinking about, that a new model is, in fact, multiple budgets, each funding a single ministry or event in collaboration, not just within the institution of the congregation, but in collaboration with other churches and organizations and charities to accomplish outcomes beyond the congregation. What I, too, am not advocating any particular course of action. Every congregation is different, so I want to make that point, that you need to think about your own situation and setting and connections and history. But I think if we allow ourselves to step significantly out of the box, at least in our thinking, and wonder where the sources of money, where the potential contributions might be that we are simply not asking, then it might be surprising what we come up with. Thanks.
Hi there, I'm Marlon Levenhart, and I'm the senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're a large congregation. We've grown from, I don't know if I said, I've been there for 16 years. We've grown from about 1,000 members to about somewhere 1,800 members, adult members now. Our budget was about, we raised about $600,000 from our members. When I came, we're raising just over $1.8 million from our members today. So I've really enjoyed the fundraising part of ministry. I've really realized that it's an integral part of the ministry. I think a lot of ministers have the idea that fundraising is something that we kind of have to do so that we can get back to doing the ministry. But I actually realized that the fundraising is one of the most key parts of the ministry itself. So I believe that the minister is probably the best fundraiser of any congregation. And if the minister's not out asking for money, then the minister is failing to do one of the most important jobs that they have in terms of tending the leadership and the growth of the institution, as well as the spiritual life of its members. Now, I know people think it's kind of interesting to talk about raising money and deepening people's spiritual life. But what I've discovered is that there's really two ways that people get more connected with our church. The first way is usually when they have a heart attack or get a really bad diagnosis or something, and all of a sudden they deepen their faith and their connection to the community. Obviously, we can't control that, and we wouldn't want to be able to do that either. But the second one is when they're asked for a major gift to the church, some stretch for them, whatever that might be in their realm, it makes them think about what the church means to them, that the congregation and community means to them, and then when they say, you know, it really does mean a lot, it really has changed my life, and then they make that larger gift, they also start getting more involved, paying more attention, and caring more about what happens in the life of the church. So what I realized is that by asking people for money, I've actually deepened their relationship with the church and their faith and their community. And so it's an integral part of my ministry to ask people for money. And I've learned that people want to put their money in the direction of their values. And so one of the roles that I have is to help people figure out, how can I use my money responsibly and put it in the direction of the values that I care most about in the world? And sometimes that might mean somebody comes to me and says, I've got some money to give away, and I'm wondering if you know of a worthy organization or project. And of course, I'm always looking for one within All Souls that I could direct them to, but sometimes it's not. And I say, you know, our interfaith community is doing this, or I know that the YWCA is doing that, and I'll direct their money somewhere else. But people come to, you build the relationships with people who have money, then they begin to come and trust you and then ask you about how they can use their money when they have money to give away. I was, one of the most interesting things for me was when an organization in my community, an interfaith organization, raised $1 million to break away from the national organization and become independent, an independent Oklahoma organization. They were so proud, and they celebrated having raised $1 million and become independent, and the interfaith community was just so happy about itself for doing this. And what happened to me was nobody asked me for a gift. So I wasn't a part of it. As they were all celebrating this historic, incredible thing that the Oklahoma Interfaith Community had done, I wasn't a part of it. I hadn't done anything to be a part of it because nobody asked me to make a gift. And I realized how disappointed I was. They don't think I matter, or no one thought to ask me, or they didn't think I had any money, or they didn't think I cared, or I'm not a part of this. And so I realized that asking people for money for something that's important, like the church or a project in the church, is a gift to them. Because when you're doing something great, people want to be a part of it at whatever level they can give. So I love asking people for money for things I care about and that I know they care about. Now, one of the things that's really important to me is cultivating the leadership in my congregation. And that means lay leaders, my board leaders, my committee chairs, but it also means my financial leaders. And this is something that people have a little bit hard time. There's a sort of a false sense of sort of equality that we get into. I don't know if it's a liberal thing or a church thing or what it is. But I've even had to explain this to my staff who sometimes go, well, is it really fair that you would put more attention to somebody who's giving the church $10,000 or $15,000, $20,000, $50,000 than you would to somebody who's just able to give $300 or $500 to the church? Isn't that unfair? Is that really ministry? Is that really what we're about? And what I helped them to understand is that actually, when I go and get the gift of $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 from somebody, that allows us to provide the church everything, our ministers, our choirs, our education programs, our building, everything else for the member who can only give $200, who actually, at $200, we can't have all that stuff. So I'm not harming or dissing the $200 giver when I spend a little bit more time and attention trying to be with somebody who I know can give a leadership gift, because that leadership gift actually impacts the family of that $200 giver incredibly, because they're actually being subsidized in the church. And they get the benefit of everything else we do. If there's an emergency, a minister is going to be in the hospital with them. If they have a memorial service, a wedding, anything else, they get everything. All the choirs, all the services, all the classes. And they can only pay $200, and that's great. But the only reason we can offer that is because as the minister and as a leader, I'm out there cultivating the leadership of major donors. I do a lot of that one-on-one. I go to people's offices and meet them for lunch. Say, can I come to your office? And I love going in and seeing their office and hearing the story of their business, going to their homes, seeing what's pictures around the walls and learning about their families and what they care about. Because one of the things I realized in fundraising is that people give to what they care about. And so in conversation with someone over time, I get to see, well, what makes their eyes light up? I had a woman whose son died of AIDS back in the 80s. And she said, you know, growing up in Oklahoma, it was really hard for him as a gay man. I mean, as a gay boy and then teen. And then, you know, so he ended up moving to San Francisco. He ended up contracting AIDS. He ended up dying tragically in his 20s. And this mother was brokenhearted. And eventually, over time, she was also homebound at this point. And so the only time she would have contact with the church was when I would go out and see her. And she said, and she used to watch the local Methodist minister on television because, you know, we weren't on TV and that was the only church that she could see. So eventually I said, you know, if we had enough money to go on television, we could actually, you could watch us, other people around us could watch in the local market, and, you know, we begin to change the culture, because the people who learn about our LGBT-friendly ideas and all this kind of stuff are only the people who self-select to come into our congregation. But if we're on TV and we're out there projecting beyond our walls, we will impact people and start to change the culture of Tulsa and Oklahoma in a way that could make a difference for other kids growing up in this community. She ended up giving us $1.7 million to do communications, outreach, audio, video. She gave us her entire estate when she died. Initially a $100,000 gift, a $500,000 gift, and then her entire estate when she died to do this ministry because it mattered to her. Because I knew what she cared about and helped her put her money in the direction of something that gave her life meaning and a sense of legacy. So I think if you believe in what you do, it's easy to raise money for it, because it's just wonderful to all of a sudden have the money to be able to do something you love. It's not like I'm raising money for myself. And that's the other thing, is that people will only give, I've learned, a certain amount. How am I doing on time? People only give a certain amount to the operating budget. I mean, even someone who has a lot of funds, they could give more. Like, the biggest donors in my church aren't giving 5%. We also ask people to do 5%. But the biggest donors aren't giving 5%. If they were, we'd be getting some pretty big checks from some folks who have a lot of money, you know, the few. And I understand that because, it, you know, 5% for them is so out of scale to everything anyone else is giving in the church. And so what I realize is, but those people do have money, more money than they're given to operating. And so if I have a special project or an opportunity, I'll go out and ask them for money for something special. And I've gotten gifts, $15,000 gift for special project, $20,000, $100,000 gifts for special projects, $30,000 for one, $50,000 for another. By going out and talking to somebody who has the means, they would never give that much to the operating. They've already given a significant gift to the operating, but then they'll give a little bit more when asked for something they care about, and if they've got the resources, they'll do it. So I think it's irresponsible leadership of an organization to not be cultivating the financial resources by talking to the folks who have them and cultivating their leadership as just as important as the leadership of those who are on the boards and serving in the committees. They're all leaders, and our jobs as ministers is to cultivate that. Now, that doesn't get everybody else off the hook, because peer-to-peer asking is an incredible way to raise money. And sometimes when I can get a donor to say, I'll give $5,000 as a matching gift, but I'd like to see other people give $5,000. I say, do you have any, you know, who in the congregation, would you be willing to ask this family? And then they'll call their friends and say, hey, I'm going to give $5,000. Have you heard about what, you know, Marlon's trying to do, or the church is trying to do, the board's trying to do? I'm going to give $5,000. Would you give $5,000? And then they, you know, and then they'll call their friend and say, hey, you know, we're giving five, they're giving five, would you give five? And sometimes that's a fantastic way for peers to ask each other, feel really good. People want to be, you know, stand with their peers in the community, and it's a great way to raise money. And that, and it's true with $1,000 or $500 or a $100 gift. If I have a moment, I'd just say something about online. Just 1 minute. We are now trying, because we use that money not to get on local television, although we're thinking about that now for next year. But we used it to get on the internet because it just made more sense to do internet ministry. So we live stream our services and we put stuff up on YouTube and iTunes and all that. That's how we've been using that money. And now we're beginning to try to figure out how we can develop more online gifts, because we have thousands of people who are accessing our sermons and our services each month. And so we're just trying to think, you know, if we get $10 gift from here, you know, $10 gift here and there, you know, people can text it in or on their computer screen. So that's just new for us. We got about 70 gifts from our online viewers last year. But we're hoping that that could be a real future source of income for us. So we haven't quite figured out how to do that, but that's our next kind of wave of fundraising. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to start this section of the conversation and then be quiet, but start you all off. I was the one who named this session, and I called it Annual Giving, the Backbone of Congregational Stewardship. Did I name it wrong?
So I'll fess up to say that when Mary Catherine had us on a call to plan this presentation, I used the term broken backbone. And I want to express my concern that we need to find alternative ways of funding our congregations. And Tricia alluded to this, the finding money around the edges. Marlon's looking at it, getting income from people who are only connected through the internet. I think it's not a sustainable model, from my perspective, to keep asking the same people for more money every year. There's a limit. And if our growth of our budgets is only sustainable by the growth in numbers of our church, that's just a tremendous challenge for us. So finding alternative sources of income, I think, is absolutely critical to supplement maybe the backbone.
So we had quite a conversation about this when we were planning this workshop. I agreed to be on this panel because my friend Mary Catherine asked me to be on a panel, and I just said yes to her before I knew what we were doing. If annual stewardship means a pledge drive, then I'm not so sure. If that's what it means, if it means, I think it's a too small backbone for what we need. But if annual giving means providing ways all year, a variety of ways for all of the people who are associated with the congregation in some way or another to learn about the congregation's budget, to think about what they're going to give and to be asked to give, then yeah, I agree with you. There are outside sources, and I think I may be wrong, but I think that those will always be on the edges. So it's the people who are somehow in our congregations that, yeah, carry it.
I want to say that I think it's both and. We need to, obviously, the annual stewardship drive is absolutely critical. I differ a little bit because I think we can continue to raise people's gifts. I don't think we've come close in any of our congregations that I know of, including mine, of actually tapping the true potential or capacity of
our
members.
So
until we get there, I'm not sure I'm too worried about raising pledges. I think we have to be thoughtful about it. So I always think of there's sort of, I'm always trying to cultivate some group to increase their giving each year. I'm trying to create a sort of a pipeline to make sure that people, you know, as we lose people who are major donors, that there's new donations coming in. So for example, so I'm looking always at the people giving 3,000, two to 3,000 to see which one of those could I ask this year to go to 5. And, you know, and then I'll go out and I'll ask, you know, 20, 30 of them to go to 5. I'll take them out to lunch, or I'll go visit with them for coffee or come to their house, and I'll say, hey, you've been giving 3,000 for a while, or you're giving 2 to 3. I noticed you went from 2 to 3 last year. We actually have a group of 5,000 and above, which is our major donor category, and so we have a circle that we invite people into. So I say, I'd like you to be a part of this leadership group. We have a special event for that group every year. And so I'll say, you know, if you're able, if you have the capacity, you're ready, I believe. I hope you feel ready financially to move to that level of leadership within our church, and more often than not, more than, you know, 4 out of 5 people will say, sure, we'll do it. And most people say, everybody says yes if they can. Every time I ask, look someone in the eyes, talk to them about our church, who love our church, they always say yes if they can. And I don't know anybody who has said yes and sort of put themselves in the poorhouse. So I'm not worried about asking somebody. People say no if they can't do it, and they don't feel pressured, and I don't think anyone has ever felt that I've given them any less pastoral care or, you know, was not as nice to them or anything because they said no to me about a gift. It's always, I always spend a nice amount of time after they ask with someone, whether they say yes or no, making sure that the relationship is really strong and intact. And that's really positive. The other thing I would just say is we've started a nonprofit now that has a different name that's not the church, so that we can get grants for some of our social justice work. So that's a new thing for us, but it's a new source of revenue. We're doing all kinds of amazing work in the community, and we realize a lot of these foundations won't give money to a church, but they are willing to give money. They do love what we're doing, so they're actually looking for a vehicle to give us money, but they know they can't from their foundation give it to a church. So we've created this new vehicle legally to take money and use. I'm forgetting what the name of it is right now. I wish my associate minister, Barbara Prost, who just set it up, they came up with a great name. And I'm going to text her in a minute. I'm going to text her in a minute and see if I can find out the name. But it's that new. It's something that we just passed through the board and just got the lawyers to help us to get it to be a legal entity just in the last couple of months. So
just one small thing I want to add. I love that, and I'm glad that you brought that up, Marlon, because I think that that's one of the ways that some congregations have had real luck with capital projects as well as programming. I just want to acknowledge that different cultures in different parts of the country are very different and have different rules and habits and manners about money. And I've never served in Oklahoma, but I'm guessing that it might be easier to have some of those conversations there or in the West or in the South than it would be in New England. And I just want to acknowledge that doesn't mean you can't have those face-to-face, look you in the eye, actually ask somebody, and I agree that most people will just say yes if they possibly can. But the way you do it actually does vary, I think, from place to place.
So, Marlon, I'd like to ask you, for all the people here who are sitting here saying, I'm going to go back to my congregation and put this in my minister's hands,
yeah.
How... How are you supported?
I hope you will.
How are you supported by your lay leaders in these efforts? I mean, you're not spending 80% of your time out, you know, shaking the bushes for money, I assume.
No.
So how do you? It's not just up to the minister, obviously. So how do you get that support?
So we. It's interesting because the church has grown, right, from 900 or so members when I came into this 1,800 members. So we've changed completely as an institution and in all of our structures. So a couple of years, 3 years ago, we actually hired a stewardship and development director. So we have a full-time person who, because we realized that working with lay people who change over year after year. Everyone comes up with a new campaign slogan, and then they have to, you know, come up with a campaign and run the campaign, and some people are better at it than others, some people have more time than others, that to do that when you're trying to raise $1.8 million a year becomes a little bit of a burden on your lay members. And so we have a professional now fundraiser, but that is a vestige of the kind of institution that I'm in. But so I'm not sure that applies necessarily across sizes of congregations, and that's why I wasn't bringing that up specifically. But that's certainly a new thing for us that seems to be paying off quite well for us. The first year that we had a professional fundraiser, we raised over a quarter million dollars more money in our operating budget in 1 year. I think it was about a little over $300,000 of new money from our members. It pays off to put money into fundraisers. Basically, we had a consultant come in, look at our organization, and he said, from a business standpoint, you have all the departments. You have accounting. You have, you know, your sales, which are your ministers. You have your, you know, different your products and services. He said, but you have nobody. Actually doing. I said sales because we're sort of like the spokespersons. But he had nobody looking at the income. You had a lot of people spending the money of the church. You had no staff person focused on the income, or like basically a sales department. And so hiring somebody who could help organize my time, set up some of those visits, make sure that I'm not eating lunch by myself unless I really want to, or, you know.
And I want to jump in because I'm afraid there might be folks in the room who are now kind of thinking that has nothing to do with me. So I want to try to draw out what is it, do you think? Well, let me be more transparent about what I'm hearing. I'm hearing a level of health and maturity about a relationship with money in the congregation, and about our willingness to talk about money, and even the minister to talk about money. And so how does that feel? Does that translate across size and even lay-led congregations? And how does it translate in your experience?
Go ahead.
So, in my experience, it's a matter of shifting your culture, and you have to have a willingness to look at money and to talk about money, not just once a year during the budget time. And for some congregations, that can be a real challenge. I know some smaller congregations with ministers where they don't let the minister even see who pledges what. You know, they're totally closed book, and that is that's not a productive way to operate. So I do think that for a lot of our congregations, getting to that point where we can openly talk about money, where we can acknowledge that everybody's capacity to give is different, and their gifts that they bring to the congregation are different, but that is a precursor to doing anything, I think, innovative around fundraising.
So I used to think that the thing that could begin to change that culture was the minister speaking openly about money. And I still think that's essential. I think that's really important. But I no longer think that that's enough for a variety of reasons that usually have to do with whatever the congregation's story about the way things used to be. So I've had good luck inviting people who don't normally talk about money to talk about money. And the people who normally talk about money, in my experience, are the finance committee and the treasurer. And I was taught by a mutual friend of ours, Peter, many years ago, that the natural gesture of the finance committee is, I'll stand up. So that kind of conversation about money only goes in one direction. But in Charleston, for example, which is a small congregation with very limited staff, I've invited some young adults who were involved in the youth program to be to imagine crowdfunding some youth projects next year. There's not money in the budget for it. There's approval from the board and the finance committee to do this. But it's so easy if you invite a bunch of young adults to think about crowdfunding and how they might put it together and why that's so it's going to happen. And that can change the culture, too, if you've got conversations about money popping up in different places.
For me, I think that one of the things people don't like about ministers raising money is having a minister stand in the pulpit every Sunday in front of everybody and say, can you give more money? Can you give more money? And half or more of the people have already given money. They're sort of like, are you going to keep talking about this? And that's why I'm saying if the minister knows who in the congregation has capacity, those of you who are here who have capacity or know people who have capacity know that people who have money have no trouble talking about money. They have no trouble being asked about money. They're being asked by their alma maters all the time. They're being asked by all kinds of people. And they're giving money all the time. They have to give money away for tax purposes. They want to give money away for all kinds of reasons, especially to put their money in the direction of their values. So instead of getting everybody tired out by talking about money constantly, I do think it's important that ministers talk about it other than just at stewardship. It's woven into sermons all the time about money and generosity. But going one-on-one to a person and sitting down with them or a couple for lunch or in their office or whatever it is and asking them for money is an easy conversation to have, and it raises a lot of money. Every minister should have a group of, depending on the size of the church, 5, 10, 20 people that they could call anytime they want, year after year, beyond their operating gift and say, hey, I need $1,000. I'm trying to raise 10 or 20, but I need 1,000 from you. And it should be a relationship such that that person would be able to say, what do you need it for? It doesn't matter. I need $1,000, and the person should give you $1,000. I mean, it should be that good of a relationship. Now, of course, that's a little bit hyperbole. You know, they want to know what it's for. But people are, you know, and then they start to expect, you know, Marlon's going to call me at some point and probably ask me for $1,000 for something. And they're ready for it. They're keeping $1,000 aside because they know it's coming. And they know every year or two they're going to get asked. And that's something that every minister could do and raise an extra $10,000 or $20,000 for something, some shortfall, some new project. And that's just the basic thing. Knowing who has capacity in your church, talking about money is something that we should all do. The other two things, our endowment committee, because I know that there's that whole sense of we're not going to give money away. Well, we finally convinced our endowment committee, it took some years, but that people will, they were saying, but people aren't giving to the endowment anymore. You know, we don't get many gifts to the endowment. I said, you know what would happen if you started to use the endowment now to do some exciting things that we couldn't do otherwise, and we promoted that the endowment helped us to do this, people would start going, hey, that endowment's doing some great things for the church. I'm going to put it in my will. So we started to get the endowment to help seed fund, matching fund for all kinds of new staff positions, new programs, and then we promote it and advertise it. And so now people are much more inclined to give to the endowment because they see it's an active endowment that's helping the congregation do things that are exciting and impactful that we couldn't do otherwise. And the last thing is when we give away, by giving away the plate, we give away 100% of the plate. And that was very controversial, even in our context. But it clarified for everybody how we raise money. Because people would say all the time, oh, you know, I don't pledge, but I put $20 in the plate whenever I'm in church. Yeah. We're not sure who's stealing all those 20s. Because we don't see them. But when we were able to say, oh, you know, hey, that's great that you're putting money in the plate, but, you know, as you know, that doesn't fund our staff, our church, and everything else, it really clarified for people that pledging to the church, giving a gift to the church, is important, and that the plate wasn't enough. And we actually started to raise much more money in our operating budget once we stopped asking people for nickels and dimes on Sunday morning.
Wow. I'm going to invite you to the microphone to form a line for your questions. I thought you might have one or two. We have at least 15 minutes for questions, so I hope we'll get through a number of these. Go right ahead.
All right. Well, I see there's a big line, so I will be as brief as I can.
I appreciate
my name
of you
is Jim
that.
Pinkham, and I'm from here in Columbus, the First Unitarian. So first, let me just say welcome to Columbus, and I hope you all are having a good time. I had two quick things. One is sort of an idea that your talk about the millennial putting a dollar in the plate inspired, and another is a question. So the first, the idea. I'd seen someone else suggest this. Is in your order of service, you can print a little Q code, is what they're called, those
QR
little
code.
QR codes, so that your smartphone can scan it, and that can take you to your online giving page. So if you're not, that seems like a nice bridge across ways of giving that might be fitting in with the alternative ways. So that's kind of neat. But my question is about my focus is with auctions, service auctions and stuff. So I'm really interested in that. But I've heard some challenges around the timing of how they can be, the perception is that they can conflict with an annual pledge drive. And I wanted to know what you thought of that, and I'll sit down and listen. And
Thank you.
To me and talk about auctions if you want to later.
One quick answer is, in one of the churches that I served, we, a stewardship task force, made some steps in the direction of real year-round giving and automatically renewing pledges. A whole bunch of other stuff went into that. But one of the most surprising things that happened as a result is that we no longer had pledge season. And what we realized about pledge season was that it was not only a season of high anxiety for 3 months, but also it was a time during which we imposed an apparently voluntary silence on money in any other context. And it felt really freeing to move away from that.
Anybody else?
Well, I'll just say that we're very intentional in making sure our auction is in the opposite season of our pledge drive. And that's how it was when I arrived there, and that seems to work. People understand that the auction income is a source of income for the operating budget. They don't seem to get it confused with the pledge drive.
Thank you. Yes, please.
It's a great segue into what I had wanted to ask. I think I want to hear a little bit more from his great question. My name is Jenny Barrington. I've served as an interim minister for 8 years, and then I was settled in Massachusetts for 7 years before that. So these questions are sort of a composite of many different sizes and types of congregations. And what I would love to hear from any number of the four of you is along the lines of how the annual pledge drive relates to all of the other fundraising needs. Because I do hear things like, well, people aren't going to pledge so much for their annual pledge because the auction's coming up and they want to spend some of their money on the auction. Since I'm an interim minister, that means we will need to raise or find somewhere approximately $9,000, give or take, to fund the search. So that's a special fund drive. And if there seems to many people to be a need for a capital campaign for a building renovation, but people get scared to start that because asking for money for that thing could harm a pledge drive, or these are some of the things that I hear from different people, and I would love to hear how it can all relate together in a positive and encouraging and hopeful way. All those. Oh, and then there's the doors. Okay. The front doors of the church need to be
good. Yeah, thank you. And can I say something from yesterday before you all jump in and share one of the things that the Reverend Lisa Greenwood shared with us about how we are so oriented around scarcity? We've all talked about this for years and years, but the response has always been abundance, abundance, abundance. And Lisa said, you know, abundance is fuzzy. It's not clear. I don't know what we're talking about. What if we focused on what is enough? It's sufficient. And the thing I want to say is that works if we know what we need, what the auction money is going for, what the annual fund money is going for, that kind of thing. So I just wanted to share that idea around scarcity and rejecting scarcity on behalf of the idea that there is enough. When we're clear and passionate about what we know we need, there's enough. Anything else to add?
So what Mary Catherine, I think, is referring to is a culture shift. And it's not going to happen overnight. But it sounds like this particular congregation has a lot of fear around money. And so how do you overcome that? And how do you change the experience? And I would, when you talked about money for the search, $9,000, do Marlon's thing. Find one or two people in the church who can give a few thousand dollars each. You'll have it funded overnight.
Right.
Great. Thanks.
Hi, I was particularly interested in Reverend Trisha's heretics because I'm Kiki Giadis. I am from the Arlington Mass congregation and have been a New Englander for several decades. And the folks that Marlon were talking about in my surroundings are boomers or late, what I call the plus 50 Gen Xers, and the younger Gen Xers and the millennials are not attached to institutions. And so our old model, I believe, like Trisha, isn't going to work. That as boomers step out into retirement or other places, that there aren't folks to step up in that kind of lead giving because they don't believe in institutions the way that we boomers do. So I'd like some comment about that or some ways that you look at the alternatives to a pledge drive,
great,
which are really attached to the church.
Thank you.
So the thing that we need to do is never separate money and asking people for their generous gifts from what they care the most about. And I think older generations did care about institutions. I include myself in that, in ways that it made sense to ask those people, ask me, support this institution because it makes a difference in the world. If we're talking to people who distrust institutions or frankly find them an annoyance of some kind, talk to them about what they care about. And the younger people and some of the older people who are part of our congregations, they will happily tell you what they care the most about. And I would just add, Marlon, I know you do this, when you're having a conversation with somebody and you're doing one of those eye-to-eye things, you telling them what you care about is an invitation for them to tell you what they care about, too. Mm-hmm. And those conversations are really easy to have.
Yep.
And the millennials are going to start making a lot of money at some point, and they're going to give their money away, too. I mean, the way that it works, it seems like people in their 20s and 30s are just starting out, but people, when they start to get into their 40s and 50s who become successful, have money, and give some of that money away. And I think we'll see the same thing coming from the Gen Xers and the millennials as they start making more money.
And I'll just relate quickly an experience we had the first year with this Five to Thrive campaign. We went out and we really were promoting the idea of being able to give away 100% of our plate cash every Sunday. And we found in particular with members of our Young Families group, they're like, that's not what's important to us. What's important to us is our religious education programming. Tell us what you're going to do about that and for that. And so I think making sure that you're matching the needs of the people you're talking to with what you're offering is vitally important.
Yeah. Thanks.
But knowing your audience.
Get them giving, though, right away. I mean, even if it's $50, once someone starts giving to an organization, then you can have something to build on.
John.
John Bosted, Knoxville, Tennessee. First, a little experience. When we had a big capital fund drive to build a new church, we had a two-year annual pledge campaign, so that gave us a year off, and then we had the capital fund drive that off year. Secondly, we said to people, this is a capital campaign, we need a capital gift, go out and borrow it. Borrow $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, you can pay back in 3 years. Give us your
next new car. Please.
Give us your next new car.
Yeah, thank you.
So that's it. Wow. Okay. My question about the culture shift, I think we got that in all directions, but we need it. But what do you do if your minister, how do you get your minister to lead a culture shift of that kind if your minister is not really oriented that way?
Well, if you're in search, you talk to everybody you talk to, and you say, are you willing to raise money? Do you raise money? What's your philosophy and theology of raising money? If you're in search, that's something you should be doing. You know, any congregation in transition should be a major question of any minister coming in my opinion. I do want to say that we, you know, I've been talking about some successes. We made a mistake a few years ago by we thought that if we asked people, if we said, you know, most of you give to the church around the same amount of money every year with small increases here and there every few years. So we're going to start a rollover campaign. We're just going to assume you're giving us the same thing you gave us last year, and we're going to target about a third of the congregation each year to increase. So we'll come and talk to you about every 3 years. Now, if you come into a lot of money, we want you to give it to us, and, you know, et cetera. But, and let us know if your finances trail off. But otherwise, we're just expecting it to roll over. This was a huge mistake. It sounds like a great idea. What I realized is fundraising is all about relationship. And actually, it's about how many touches you have with someone that increases the gift. And so by having the rollover, it's basically saying, you don't talk to us, we won't talk to you, right, and we just keep your gift, you know, kind of where it is. Every 3 years, we'll touch you with some, you know, invitation. That's a big mistake. It's all about touching folks. And so what we try to aim for is thanking people 7 times for every 1 time that we ask them for money.
Thank you for saying
beautiful.
That.
Beautiful.
Thanks.
And if I could just to your question specifically, sir, I would say that some ministers may be concerned that money is the third rail in the congregation, and they're afraid of it. They're afraid to touch it. So if you, as lay leaders, can empower and give permission to your ministers to go that way and say that's what you want, that's what you need, be clear about that and encourage them and support them in that, that's the power that you hold as members of the congregation.
And I want to add one more thing, because we have different gifts, right? And we have different levels of comfort. And if you can let your minister know that there are resources available, if they're feeling like they don't have the skills, they don't quite know how to get started on this, tell them that the UUA Stewardship and Development Department is really happy to talk with them and maybe match them with a coach if they're interested in that kind of thing. There are lots of resources available to help folks. Marlon's a shining example of this, and it takes a while to build those skills and that comfort. So offer support. I'm sorry for taking time.
That's fine. I did want to echo that, after years and years of giving, that even though it might be at the cause, that's the concern. Eventually you start worrying whether the institution can handle it. So, I mean, there is that maturing into the institution concern and putting the money there. My question was, when you have these giving circles, the bigger major donor circles. Mm-hmm. Is there anything innovative going on in terms of the group itself being interactive compared to just the one person talking to each donor and peer-to-peer single person? Is there something going on innovative in terms of the group dynamic with those?
It's a good question. We have this dinner every year. And it's actually sponsored by one of the major donors. So we don't use church funds for it. We don't use operating funds for it. It's privately funded party each year, and we do it usually before the stewardship drive launches so that we get these, you know, larger gifts first. Sometimes we'll ask them, you know, say we want to do a matching gift for every increased dollar we'd like to match, you know, up to a certain amount, and we'll get that group to all agree together, okay, we'll each give an extra X amount in order to do this, to inspire the rest of the congregation to give for this purpose or this vision. So we do things like that, but we help that group feel like they're in the know about what's happening, what's coming next. They don't get surprised and hear about things through the grapevine or just through the newsletter. It helps them to feel sort of special. They realize, you know, I'm giving $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 to this church. It's nice to feel like I know what's happening with the money. So we give them a sense of feeling special because they are special. They're allowing us to teach Sunday school and offer LGBT ministries and all prison ministries and all kinds of things because they're giving a considerable amount more than a lot of people could give that allows the church to do a lot more than we can. So we thank them. It's mainly a thank you dinner, but it's also creating a community and it's helping people realize that, hey, I do matter to this congregation and my gift matters, and I think sometimes we're afraid to give people that kind of attention, and I hope we can get over that because it's not a disservice to people who don't have money at all.
We're afraid to do it about money. We're not afraid to do it about other things, right?
Right.
We pay special attention to other groups.
Right. And we do parties for all volunteer leaders. We do, you know, all kinds of volunteer recognition. So it's not, these aren't the only leaders that get a special attention. Anybody who's providing leadership in the church in any capacity gets thanked, gets honored, gets valued, gets extra time with the staff and the ministers. That's just basic organizational development.
I'm Bruce Koepke. I'm with the UU Society of Mill Creek in Newark, Delaware. You can ask me where that is later.
I know.
He knows.
And if we're fast, we might get all three questions.
Okay, so sorry. This is tangential to what he just said. You have this group of powerful donors. Some of it's pledged, some I assume special gifts. And you recognize them for themselves. Does the rest of the congregation know who they are?
I mean, we don't necessarily publish their names as a group.
You don't have a platinum list.
Or a platinum list or anything like that. But generally, a lot of folks know who they are. Some are more anonymous, but it's not like a shadow group or anything. They're just people who love the church. Most of them are very active. A few of them aren't as active. They're older. They're not as active in a day-to-day basis. But one thing we find is that people who give a lot of money to the church tend to be the ones who are also in the kitchen stirring the potatoes for the church dinners and doing a lot of the work on the boards and putting in the time as well. It just seems like people who give a lot, care a lot, and get involved. So these aren't people who are sort of aloof trying to run the church or anything.
Okay, so you don't have a recognition for these folks, and also the recognition for the people who clean up the restrooms, or
not in that way. No, okay. Not.
Thank you for your question.
Yes, my name is Craig Zier, and I'm from the Edmonds UU congregation in Edmonds, Washington. We have 170 pledge units. 10 years ago, anyway, 170 pledge units, and we made a decision 10 years ago to just give 100% of the plate away. Just not try to figure out, can we give half on one Sunday or a Sunday? We just said all of it's going to nonprofit organizations. Each month, those nonprofits that are going to get the plate come in and explain what's going to happen to the money from the pulpit. They are very thankful. This has opened up a huge new revenue stream for the nonprofits, and in the last 10 years, we've given away $400,000.
Yes.
So I encourage you, sir, to just give it 100% away. Your operating budget is not going to be affected. Secondly,
is it a question? Can I?
Yes.
Okay, great.
So the Five to Thrive, thank you for that. The clarity of that vision is really helpful. And, you know, I don't have a question, but
thank
I just want to
thank
you.
So let me just tell you, I do have some copies of our pledge card, our brochure, and a thank you card that we use. So after we're done, feel free to come up and grab them. I don't want to take them home.
No, that's fine.
Wayne Beloy from the Unitarian Congregation in Westchester, Pennsylvania. And I'm wondering about this professional fundraiser. Is that a staff position that could be shared between like five small congregations?
I don't know why
and
not.
Is there a can you give us like a cost benefit to convince us that's something worth putting money into doing?
I don't know why it wouldn't be of value to. I think it would make sense for a group of congregations to pool their resources to have a fundraiser who helps. That seems like it makes sense if you could find somebody to do that. The cost benefit, as I said. The first year we made over $300,000 of new money came in through the operating campaign, and the person was paid with benefits and everything around $80,000.
Just a comment. What we do, Dave Michael, East Shore Unitarian Universalist in Kirtland, Ohio, we put up three plaques at different giving levels, but we only say how many people contributed at that or above that level, and that has turned out to focus attention on, oh, if I give this much, I'll get on that that one of those numbers is mine, without giving out names.
Thanks. Well, okay, this is our last comment or question.
Good. I hope it's a good one.
Yeah.
Melissa Marion Landay. I'm the president of the board at UUCA in Atlanta. A little conspicuous by its absence, I feel, is a UUA's Fair Share Giving Guide, which was not mentioned at all, except that you said you're not using it. I guess I'm wondering here at this giant UUA setting what we might say about people who are up here talking about new, innovative, creative ways to talk about stewardship, and nobody's talking about the Fair Share Giving Guide.
Good. So do you all want to address? I want to. Yes,
go
please.
Ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I don't.
Go ahead.
Okay, good. We think that it may be time to look at the Fair Share Guide because we've heard a number of questions about it. We also hear consistently from congregations how helpful some of them find it. So we're hearing lots of things. I want to recognize Barry Finkelstein, who's in the room, who is one of the consultants for the Stewardship for Us team. You can find them online, Stewardship for Us, for UUS, or just us?
Just us.
Just us. Stewardship for Us. They have some really good work. They have done some really good work with the Giving Guide, and they have a number of other resources, so that's another place for you to look. Please call on us. Here is our email address and our phone number if you have more questions, and we're right at the end of our time, so I'm going to ask you to join me in thanking these wonderful leaders in stewardship. And then Marlon's going to have a last word.
Well, I didn't know the name of the nonprofit that we started, so I texted the associate minister of our church, who's Reverend Barbara Prose, is fantastic and does so much of what makes our church wonderful. And she said the name is Rise Tulsa, and the RISE stands for Respect, Inspire, Serve, Empower Tulsa. And so it's RISE Tulsa. It doesn't say anything about the church. It's a way that granting organizations can give money for our social justice ministries and support those ministries.
Thank you all so much. 4:45 is our next session on creative fundraising.